Welcome back to Word Balloon in association with iFanboy. This is John Suntris, and this is an experiment because I've been having issues with the latest Word Balloon episode featuring Matt Fraction. And it's a good episode because we discuss Fear Itself, the brand new spring and summer event for Marvel Comics that Matt is in the process of writing. Stuart Immonen is the artist. We talk about that along with Iron Man 500, the various things that are happening in Thor. Plus, we start answering your questions that are posted at the iFanboy website. So, again, forgive the nakedness of this intro, but without further ado, part one of the Fireside Chat with Matt Fraction, right here on Word Balloon. It's time again for another Fireside Chat with Matt Fraction. I'm thrilled. It's been far too long. Welcome back.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, it's been like 7 months, because my baby is 7 months.
I was going to say, the life of Tallulah. Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm literally putting another log on the fire right now as we speak to ensure creaking and cracking and popping in the background. You're going to hear a little bit.
Excellent. And I'm sure in Portland it's a balmy, like, probably 40 degrees or something like that right now?
It's actually not too bad. It's sort of rainy and chilly, but not necessarily cold. It's not too bad out here.
We got our single-digit weather right here in Chicago, so thanks, buddy.
It's nowhere near. Yeah, I mean, the year he lived in Chicago, it was 108 on Bastille Day, and then that winter, it got 44 below in the calendar year. It was the hottest and the coldest I had ever been in my entire life. I just put like a super crackly log on. Do you hear that?
I do hear that. That's very good.
Oh, it's crazy. That is not special effects, friends. That is not people out there in radio land. That is not... That is not the Foley. That is the real deal. That is the real McCoy. My feet are getting warmed as we speak.
Kel is not sitting off mic with a piece of cellophane plastic that she's just crackling for us or anything.
No.
Okay, fair enough.
But she sends her regards.
As always. And I'm thrilled for both
Henry,
of you.
Henry said that he is a dragon, and Tula didn't say anything because she's just a baby.
I'm sure Henry's beside himself with Christmas. Or is,
yeah,
he, or is he a Hanukkah kid?
No. It's funny. He goes to like a Jewish daycare.
Okay.
It's a great daycare. It just happens to be attached to, you know. So he picks up kind of bits. Like the other day, somebody just said the word blessing in some connection with something, and he began to sing the bread blessing, which was really special. And you know, every now and again, however, Friday is Shabbat, so it's
sweet.
Yeah, we are raising him with just as much confusion as humanly possible.
And you're just back from Singapore.
Yeah, dude, I was in Singapore. Oh, my God, have you ever been to Singapore?
No, but I've heard about this comic, you know, convention or whatever it is, going back to Colleen Duran a few years ago. So tell me about this year's experience.
Yeah, man, it is a whole nother country over there, man. Let me tell you what. Yeah, it's a Reed show. It's supposed to put on C2E2, and they were looking to really grow in like a kind of interesting and dynamic way. And there's a vital, exciting show in Singapore. It's sort of a spread of kind of like a pop culture focus, but you know, obviously with a much more Asian influence than American. You know, the biggest line of the weekend was for this designer for Tokidoki, which is I asked what was that line for, and I told me the guy's name, and I'm like, what does he do? And they said, oh, you know, he does Tokidoki. It's a lifestyle brand. Isn't that like wow? What is that? Yeah. That is incredibly Asian in conception and execution. The biggest line is for a lifestyle brand. Yeah, you would know it like if you saw it. It's this kind of like violent bear, kind of a cutie pie style. And yeah, they make like hats and you know socks and backpacks and stickers and stuff, and it's really ubiquitous when you see it. Like, oh yeah, I've seen that shit everywhere. Like, yeah, and then,
like Johnny Chimpo in Super Troopers, basically.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. But a little bit like the Johnny Cupcakes. You know Johnny Cupcakes, but yeah, it's
all right.
So it was a crazy line for that was the rock star of the show was the guy who puts bears on hats. The whole thing was magnificent.
Who were the other Americans that were there?
It was me and Ivan Brandon.
Cool.
And Gail Simone was there.
Lovely.
And we're the only Americans. I'm sure. CB Cebulski came over. from Marl. That was pretty great.
Excellent.
Alex Maleev, who is not American by birth, but at least by residence.
Okay.
And Cameron was there, Giuseppe Camoncoli, who does still live in Italy.
Yeah, Western creators, though. But yeah, Western.
Yeah.
Non-Asian.
And Esad Rivik.
Cool. Oh, very good.
And I'm sure there are people I am forgetting, but I'm still kind of jet lagged, so my apologies.
Not at all, man. And no, I appreciate you doing the interview so close to you snapping back, because I can imagine with the hours difference and stuff, your clock's all backwards and everything.
Yeah, man, this is the best. Was I left Singapore at 4:30 on Monday afternoon, and I arrived at LAX at 4:30 on Monday afternoon.
See, time machine.
Or whatever it was, 4:05. Yeah, no, it was very bizarre. I had my first Ambien experience, which actually let me sleep on an airplane for the first time in my life. And I thought I was over it, and then the other night, like, I didn't sleep at all. So it's like, okay, apparently. You don't just shake jet lag off in a night or two.
Well, that's too bad. But cool city? Do you have a chance to be able to see stuff and everything?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we were given the red carpet e-ticket tour of the place, and it's just startling and sort of suggests, you know, what the world is going to look like as a whole in like 50 years. Just an amazing mashup of cultures and people, amazing food. It's just crazy. It's kind of a mix of all sorts of different Asian cultures and sort of Middle Eastern cultures to an extent. It's great. And this is going to sound very rudimentary, very unlike anything in America. You know what I mean? Like just a profoundly other experience, which is good for the soul on some level.
Very cool. Fantastic. Now you're in the midst of a lot of big moments coming up.
I sent 78 pages to press this week.
Jesus.
78, that is fucking nuts.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm, you know, obviously everyone's excited about what's coming with Iron Man 500, and I'm surprised at the level of how much of the details of the story have come out. And I mean, it was great to see the preview pages, but yeah, I was like, wow, this is a lot of information. We know about we're going to see the son of Tony Stark. It's the Mandarin.
Yeah, yeah.
You start talking and then I'll ask some questions about what we know and what you're willing to tell us about.
It's kind of, if I call it the halfway point, I don't mean this is literally the halfway point and I've only got another 33 issues in me and I'm done, or 36 issues or whatever it is. But it is, for all intents and purposes, the halfway point in this kind of uber story that I've been telling. And it's pretty monumental. I didn't have it kind of planned from the get-go. But when somebody pointed out, you know, you're about a year away from 500, I started to think about it and just came up with this notion that we've been planting all these seeds for so long. It would be cool if, you know, the story is always, we see the seeds start to sprout. You know what I mean? You plant something, pay off, and then just as it pokes through the ground, you know, good triumphs over evil, the story ends. You never get a chance, you know. So the idea was, well, what if we pretend that we didn't renumber? What if we pretend this comes from like 38 years in the future? What if we didn't renumber? And this is literally Iron Man 500. We don't renumber from right now. And the story we're telling comes to fruition. What would Iron Man 500 be? So we're basically cutting forward in time 470 issues. And you get to see, and all the characters age in that time. So you get to see Tony Stark as a 70, whatever year old man, and the world 70 years on, as this story that I've been building really from the beginning comes to the bad ending. This is the worst case scenario. So we are going to know in no uncertain terms what the stakes are that Tony is fighting for. We will have seen the end, the bad end of this story, including the death of Tony Stark. So, you know, it's always fun to get to write that sort of stuff.
That, excellent. And we'll also see his son, Howard Stark, who apparently is working for the Mandarin.
Yeah. Howard has flipped. Howard is on the other team, and then he's got a an insurgent granddaughter, Ginny, who has broken from her father and his alliances and allegiances with the Mandarin, and has become sort of a weapon maker extraordinaire for an insurgent group, a suicide bombing, take no prisoners, last defense for mankind, kind of human Taliban, if you will, against Mandarin and his forces, which are up to more than just conquering the world. Although they've done that, but the story isn't really about conquering the world. There's something else they're up to, and that's kind of where we find them on the eve of victory, basically.
We just wrapped up a story in Avengers, I should say. Bendis and Romita Jr. Just wrapped up that story, and there was a
don't downplay your contribution there, John. You were instrumental.
Shut up. That's good. Good gem.
Merry Christmas, you big galoot.
There's this obvious future Tony Stark story in that. Does that at all fall into what you're doing?
Yeah, it was one of those things where, a little bit.
Interesting.
There's sort of, I'm a fan of the, you know, many futures theory of.
Sure.
But to a degree, there's a couple of critical moments.
Because Tony brought something back from the future, and obviously, that's kind of the elephant in the room as far as the Avengers book goes. And I was wondering if, that impacted at all what you're doing.
We had this kind of, what's the word? Well, you know, a lot of this stuff ends up being happy coincidence. A lot of this stuff ends up being, oh, you could do this, and I could do this, and look over here, and suddenly you've got a conspiracy. You know what I mean? what started as you it was like, you know, three guys all wear white shirts. It's like, oh, look, let's pretend we're in a gang. Suddenly you're a gang. You know what I mean? So, yeah, we're all looking for ways to kind of dovetail. But this story, this future with Mandarin and, the squid bots in particular, are it's been a long time in coming. And I think puts a really giant ticking time bomb under the table of the series now that we know. Even if we don't quite know how, the how is more interesting than the what. But we are very explicit about what Tony is ultimately dealing with, what he's ultimately fighting against. And then, you know, when we come back to 501, we know so much more than he does, which is always fun to put like the world's smartest man behind the rear a few steps.
Understood. So, okay. Interesting. Okay. So yeah, we will see, as you say, a possible ending to that story, and then pick things up back in the present.
Yeah.
Cool.
And there's a hopefully just as many questions as there are answers. The exact nature of the crisis and how we're going to get from here to there, and also who does Tony sleep with to have a son, all kinds of fun stuff.
Well, you've just answered one of Nani's questions. One of the people that went to iFanboy and asked questions for us because he wondered if the flying squid robots in Tony's mind were going to play a role in the series later on, and you've just answered that.
Yes, Iron Man 500 is shows that those weren't just figments of his imagination necessarily, or rather there is a connection. And I think after between the annual 500 and the end of Resilience, specifically the 33, the annual the Iron Man 33 and then Iron Man 500 will sort of unify everything that's come before in kind of a, you know, it's that sort of moment when the symphony all comes together and all the different pieces interlock, and suddenly you're like, oh, okay, and things dating back to Five Nightmares will all kind of come into focus. What was just sort of a story point or a hint of flavor suddenly takes on importance as when you look at those three issues together, this much more complex and unified picture is presented for the first time. So, yes, the squids are crucial.
Very cool. There's some great preview art at Marvel.com, and if you just go to the Iron Man 500 page over there.
Or don't. Maybe we've told you too much. Again, it is also 50. It's 50, 50, six pages by me, and then nice. There's an eight-page short by Nick Spencer and Barry Kitson that sets up their Iron Man 2.0 series. So you're dealing with that 56-page main feature. There's an awful lot of reading to do. It is an awful big book. Yeah.
That's cool.
We haven't spoiled all of it.
Well, 2.5 sizes of a normal issue for $4.99, that's a hell of a deal. And actually with Nick's story, even more so, basically the equivalent of three books for $4.99.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, this is big, this is real. Like, this is a huge, you know, we're entering into this. You know, this isn't a book to trade weight for, you know.
Sure.
Stuff is happening, and you're starting to see it now in other books. So,
well, I'm excited to see you get back to the Mandarin because that annual was so much fun. We talked about it in a preview sense when we last talked, but
Jesus, it was that long ago. Yeah. Holy cow!
But it was really interesting, and I it's not like I said what I've read so far about 500 sounds great. So. Very cool.
Yeah, well, I hope folks dig it. But it's a self-contained story. You can come in with this, even though it ties all this stuff together. Like I said, it just kind of presents an ending. Whether you've been reading since issue one or not, you'll still get the full scope of the magnitude of threat Tony Stark is ultimately facing. So it's a great jumping on point. It's a bargain, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. We've got four artists on it because I don't make life complicated enough for my editors on a daily basis. But every time we cut to a different character, we cut to a different artist. So it's a cornucopia of visual stylings. And I just couldn't be more proud.
Would you care to mention your artists for the issue?
Oh, shit. Yeah, sure. No, Salvador LaRocca does the... He's our series artist, and at this point, at least until Bendis and Bagley get rolling again, I believe we've got the longest uninterrupted streak of anybody at Marvel at this point, so we are making a run for it. Salva handles the present-day stuff. Carmine. Domenico? I'm not sure how to say his last name.
That sounds embarrassing.
Carmine D. Gian Domenico. Sorry, Carmen. It is late. I am jet lagged, and you are very Italian. Carmine, who did the Mandarin annual, does Old Man Tony.
Cool.
Nate Fox, an old buddy of mine from Kansas City, handles the Howard Stark pages. And then Kano does Ginny Stark stuff, and he's like inking and coloring himself. And it's insane. It is crazy, next level, beautiful stuff. And the whole issue feels like an issue of heavy metal, like from the 70s. It's very, it's super, super cool.
Days of Future Past. I like it. No, that's cool, man. Very nice. I one thing I've been wondering, now your series of Iron Man started right on the heels of the film. And, I kind of sense a slight shift in Tony Stark's persona from what we've read for decades. And that's okay because, you know, comic book characterization is pretty elastic. And if you look back at what Batman was saying in 1980, it's a lot different than the way he's portrayed in 2010. And I wonder how much of that plays directly. I know that you've had influence as far as story, I think, where you and the filmmakers were kind of on the same page. And we're seeing that with Tony's even long-term plans of energy for the world. You know, he just seems like more of a wise ass. I'm all for it. But I see it in the cartoon, and I wonder if that plays in at all at how you write Tony these days.
Well, I mean, I had sort of four or five issues in the can when the movie came out, and I had no, like, special access to the first film at all. I was just kind of trying to write the book I wanted to read, and I hoped, based on the kind of creative people behind the scenes, that I was writing a book that would feel like, I hope that they were making the kind of movie that I wanted to see. You don't put Robert Downey Jr. And Gwyneth Paltrow in your movie if you want, you know, the Phantom or whatever. They were just clearly going for something that we hadn't really seen. So I kind of was just writing the guy I wanted to read, and I like Tony as a kind of know-it-all smartass. Yeah, it wasn't until it was nice when the film came out. It felt like, okay, good. Everybody kind of has the same idea of who this guy is. I wanted somebody who really loved his life. You know, loved the at least both Howard Hughes and Chuck Yeager. You know, I wanted mm-hmm. That's going to be somebody who's fun to hang out with. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, it fits the basic
character. It felt right to me. It felt true to me. And in terms of, like, his, like, mission shifting, you know, it's tricky when a character is an inventor. You know, just the nature of science has changed, of technology has changed so much over the last 44 years mm-hmm. of Iron Man comics. You kind of can't... he can't, you know, originally the key to the Iron Man armor was transistors.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Oh, right, transistors. You know, so you kind of have to keep pushing and shifting. And it just didn't make sense to me that a guy who you know, purported to be a futurist, a visionary and all that stuff would still be playing the same games he's playing, because those guys aren't anymore. Those guys are gone. Those dinosaurs of the Cold War, those dinosaurs of the 20th century are largely gone. They've evolved, they've grown, they've changed. They aren't playing the same old, same old gag.
I even meant more on a personal level. I mean, that's the thing. I agree with you. I think from a science standpoint, absolutely, it has to move forward. But it's, you know, like almost a comparison of what maybe Stark was influenced by Sean Connery, say 65, as being kind mm-hmm. of a playboy billionaire kind of jet setter and everything, versus today's Robert Downey portrayal, where it is more, you know, like I said, just a little more real and a little more of a like Eric and wise ass.
I guess it just sort of, I mean, maybe it's just how I write it. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm not even saying it's necessarily there or not. I wonder if it does influence, just because it's that thought of millions of people have now seen the Robert Downey Iron Man rather than...
Yeah, but, you know, but I was always sort of pregnant with it when I saw it. You know, I had the experience of, as the credits were rolling, thinking, God, I wish I wrote Iron Man, and then remembering that I did, and going home and writing issue 4, issue 5, whatever it was. And then, like this last run, The Resilient, is very much sort of my take, on the sequel. It was sort of where I was heading. It was where they were heading. I mean, the energy thing is just sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not hard to think of. You know what I mean? It's
sure.
Like, well, it's either telephony or power. So, and who, you know, wants to read a comic about phones? Says the guy who just made people read a comic about cars. I don't know. It just sort of felt logical. It's just kind of, this is the way the world is going to be remade next. This is the next leap forward, you know. Our kids are going to look at the giant boxes we have sitting on our desks and call computers and they'll laugh. and one day they'll be amazed that you didn't plug a car into a wall, you know. It just sort of seemed logical. It just seemed like somebody, you know, studying. It just seemed like the logical extension.
Have they named
a lot of fun.
Have they named the generation that Henry and Tallulah are part of? I know my nephew is a millennial, and I don't know what
a millennial. Interesting.
Yeah.
No, this would have to be later than that, wouldn't it? This would have to be like,
Yeah, I don't know.
No.
Okay.
The Gabbas. This is the Yo Gabba Gabba generation. They're the
Very
Gabba
nice.
Generation.
Very nice. I certainly hope so. Let's hope that sticks.
I took him to the Yo Gabba Gabba live show. It was great. It was like a Flaming Lips concert for toddlers. Amazing.
That's terrific. Very nice. All right, let's move on to Thor, because obviously big things happening in Thor. And I love the tease for January's issue, too, that even Thunder Gods have father issues or something like that.
Oh, is that it? That's pretty good. Yeah, I didn't see that.
Odin is back, and he seems to be pissed based on next month's cover.
Yes, it is not.
You did great, kid. The town's in ruins, and your boys did great.
Yeah, that's good. The last time we saw Odin, he was happily, he was kind of retired. He's like, no, I'm just going to be here, like, in limbo, hunting monsters and fighting like a dude, just having a good time. You know, that was it. He's like, I'm here, go forth, Thor, go be king, go take care of everything. You do it, do a great job, son. I'm fine. And, you know, Thor and Odin sort of smiled and waved and went their separate ways. And now in like 10 minutes, Thor has gotten things so bad, he's had to bring Odin back. And yeah, Odin sees, okay, so let's see, the city has fallen, is broken into a billion pieces, and you brought Loki back, and you're in trouble. You suck. you embarrassing child. So, Odin is pissed, and it's fun to write him as that sort of bellowing, angry, you know, big king, like that big kind of Shakespearean, big acting, like just give him John Huston's voice in your mind. You know what I mean? Like he's just got that crazy.
Yes, I do.
So. Anyway, it's fun to write Odin angry. You know, it's fun to write a bitchy, mean Odin the way he used to be.
Well, and capable in battle. I enjoyed seeing that in this month's issue of him taking care of things, even in limbo. And he's got that Valhalla kind of, you know, every day is another challenge to slay the dragon, literally. Kind of fun.
Yeah, it's so much, it's such a different energy than kind of where the Asgardians are right now. So it's great to bring him back.
Well, and I'm always used to seeing him almost like you see in the trailers for the new film, where it is Odin on his throne, and it always is just kind of, you know, kind of just lording over his land and just kind of waiting for the action to come to him rather than this proactive Odin that we're seeing in your portrayal.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted just his personality to be back in that, you know, kind of in the way it was in the myths too, you know, mean and petty and, you know, all that kind of the great sort of Zeus, Odin, archetypes of the kind of fickle thug of a god.
Are you reaching to Norse mythology in terms of, you know, like what was happening during the Odin sleep and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, a little bit. I mean, that's just for sort of just to kind of reset some of the characters or recalibrate rather some of the characters. I mean, that's why Loki came back as a kid. The character of Loki in the Norse myths kind of grows wicked over time. In the earlier bits of the cycle, he's really funny. And when he and Thor are boys, he's hilarious. He really is a trickster. And you know, Thor, who has always kind of been burdened with this kind of violent, you know, a temper and sort of sense of war as a responsibility, was always amused and sort of delighted by his brother, and they contrast each other very nicely, and so it really takes on a level of tragedy as his fucking around and can, you know, ultimately causes all the trouble that it causes. So I wanted, and I couldn't buy that there would be Loki again as an adult who they just wouldn't brain, you know. So I wanted a Thor that felt something. I wanted a Thor that I wanted Thor more than anyone to feel the weight of what Siege was and the end of Loki was, and to be really wounded and hurt by that, and not just have it be, he's gone, good riddance. I wanted to, you know, he was great once. They loved each other very much. And now to have him back, it's, I've got this kind of bellowing Odin and sort of these sketches of, you know, Shakespearean death metal thing happening. To have a kid who can crack jokes and can, you know, be a trickster and an imp, you know, is great. He's a wonderful presence to have. You know, he's sort of, you know, like Tintin.
Sure. Well, and also kind of in the same way that Rick Remender is playing in Uncanny X-Force with Apocalypse, it has that note of the baby Hitler syndrome of, uh-oh, we know what this person can become.
Exactly.
And that's what Odin obviously sees. And you can appreciate, again, coming off of Loki's death, Thor wanting to be protective and remembering this Loki rather than the evil Loki.
Yeah, you know, we meet him. He's a card sharp in Paris, like flirting with women. You know, he's 13 years old. He doesn't even, you know what he's doing, but he knows how to flirt and charm women. And that's like, you know, it's just something. Yeah, hopefully we'll if I do my job right, you know, kid Loki will be, you know, loved and adored the way Thor loves and adores, and will understand sort of the tragedy of what a wicked outcome really is. You know, or hey, he's Loki, maybe he's fucking with us all along.
Well, and that's true, and that's, you know, that's always the mark of a good villain, is you understand his motivations and you can appreciate things from his perspective and not just love him as a villain, but also feel for him because you see whether it's humanity or whatever the good side is of a character.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Awesome, man.
Yeah, it's the, I understand the attraction of wanting to tell, like, Anakin Skywalker's story. You know, like, we've already seen him as Darth Vader, now it's seen him as Anakin. Hopefully, we are actually good.
I was going to say, but absolutely, man, there you go. Danger, Will Robinson. That's all right. No, I think it's a good start. And, again, I think it puts Thor in a different place of responsibility and duty. So.
And it adds a little bit of light. As we're kind of, I like my stuff, you know, somewhere between Jack and Walter. I like the kind of cosmic Shakespearean bigness and, you know, lots of raised voices and fists on tables and kind of over the top, you know, angry gods bellowing at each other in cavernous halls.
With a dash of aliens.
Yeah, exactly, which is kind of Pascal's genius, is, you know, what are you drawing? Wow, he just draws stuff like, that's amazing. I don't even, just go nuts, do what you want, you know, like this guy's a storm giant. I don't know what they look like. Make it awesome, and out comes a storm giant. It's brilliant.
Well, and alien planets
raining blood. But then, like, he'll do stuff, like, he'll add little bits, like when Thor flies in, like, Loki's flopped upside down, so Thor's kind of holding him, like, butt up in the air. It's just these little physical bits of comedy. It's nice to, in the middle of going for all this kind of bigness, to have somebody who can let just a hint of fresh air in the room and, you know, tell a joke. But yeah, the Norse myth, man, Loki's hysterical, and Loki is absolutely, to this day, like, does things that are, like, laugh out loud funny.
And I love the alien armada coming in, and, you know, I mean, that's,
man,
that's always fun,
yeah.
You know, right from the raining blood to... where we are right now, and especially I left Volstagg to Baldur. Like, you know, you really suck as a king.
You're a horrible king. I know.
Poor Baldur.
Terrible king. Oh, Volstagg. Yeah, I want to. I want to do a story where we see that once upon a time, Volstagg really was everything he says he was. He was the most handsome and the strongest, and something horrible happened, and he's basically been a stress eater ever since. Like, he's trying to eat the shame of it.
Back then,
you know, Fandral was known as, like, Fandral the Average.
Have you ever seen Chimes of Midnight, the Orson Welles film?
Oh, sure.
Okay, because, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I know, obviously, that Volstagg is Jack Falstaff. Disguised, and yeah, I think really people need to see, people that are fans of Volstagg, if you've never seen that film, watch it, because really, when you get to see Orson Welles play this kind of character, it's well worth it. And I see that in Volstagg, and I, at least I've seen it the way Brian and Reed and you have been writing him, so.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely, yeah, and again, he's a great character. He's terrific. Yeah, it's, he's one of my favorites. I could just sort of write him. I mean, that the pleasure of writing that entire first issue and basically getting to do, like, a, you know, this big conversation with Volstagg was just great. Just to, like, you know, have him threatening and bellowing and being an asshole and he's just in the pie. It's just so great. That's so fantastic.
I just
the character. I mean, not my own work. I wasn't just complimenting myself. It's just the character of Volstagg that has been built over the years is just magnificent.
I quite agree.
As it turns out, that Shakespeare kind of knows what he's doing.
Now, I haven't seen the map that gives us the nine worlds of Thor. Should I be looking at that? Is there a telltale sign in that that might inform the story moving forward? Here it is. I've just brought it up for my own purposes now.
Only that Asgard is empty. The rest, it's not the map that you should keep your eye on, but rather the tree. But yeah, all hell comes to Broxton. And when you're going forward, one of the things I want to keep is some of those refugees stay. Like, I kind of want Broxton to be like, have like a hint of northern exposure in Twin Peaks, where it's a town where, yeah, there's a storm giant who just lives over there. You know what I mean? And just keep that kind of, have that interaction. It's nice having all those characters just on this, it's just hanging out, you know? And existing in the same town, it adds to that place's uniqueness and strangeness. So, we won't be saying goodbye to everybody at the end of the arc. Some of these kind of weirdos are going to stick around.
Cool. Very nice. And Uncanny X-Men, you're in your story here. Wait a minute.
We are quarantined. Yeah. It is basically we introduced about a year and a half ago that the Sublime, these guys working in the name of the Sublime Corporation, had developed a flu that affected mutants. And now they have unleashed it on Utopia, and as the epidemiology, what is it called when you study a disease? It's epidemiology? What is it called?
I'll go with that. That sounds right to me.
Sure.
Judges, thank you. All right.
Yeah. Well, as the X Club are frantically trying to discover the origins of the plague and figure out what its effects are and how bad it reaches it's just rampaging through the folks on Utopia. We have a few X Men loose in San Francisco out to cover the bases, and then Sublime reveals his real play, what his real. The lobe of the Sublime reveals what his move has been all along, which is to kind of make mutancy a form of plastic surgery, a thing that the very rich can afford to do. And he unveils his custom-made X-Men. So it's a lot of kind of fun, you know, who's who kind of games we get to play. And we get to go through the fun of seeing what happens to Wolverine when his immune system shuts down and can no longer stop his bloodstream from succumbing to adamantium poisoning.
Now, Neftones at the iFanboy board wanted to know if you're staying on Uncanny, or is Kieran Gillen going to take over at some point as Soul Writer, a la Ewan Brubaker?
Yeah, I don't know. My name's on the book for the time being, and working with Kieran is a joy and a delight. And It truly couldn't be in finer hands than Kieran's. But stay tuned, I guess.
And Greg Land is doing the current arc. He's done several arcs, obviously, since you've come on. And who takes over? Does it go back to the Dobsons after Greg's run?
I know Greg can't do it
monthly, obviously, and
he can kind of crank, but I don't know if he's doing this. I'm not sure what the art plans are going forward. I'm not sure. I don't know, honestly. The script that'll come, you know, the scripts will come post quarantine. It has just gone in this week, so we should be finding out pretty soon what the story is.
Okay, and forgive me, Matt. I'm an idiot when it comes to the X-verse. Fill in any blanks you feel necessary, because I'm the worst person to ask what's going on in X-Men books these days.
I think that's the large of the short of Uncanny right now. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say. With the X-Men, as always with those wacky mutants, it is a high drama, 24/7, 365.
Okay, and you know, this is being released on Tuesday, and I guess some big news came out today, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. Now, I'm asking blindly because I'm not subject to this news.
Well, in April, a big, honking, mighty Marvel mega event will be unleashed upon us all, upon you all, I should say, as it's me and Stuart Immonen doing the unleashing. It is called Fear Itself. It is 7 issues. It is the biggest thing I have ever been a part of. This came about when I was asked to. When it was like, hey, you know, this summer there's a Thor movie and there's a Cap movie, and all of the eyes of the world are going to be on, you know, Marvel characters. Maybe can we look for, is there a good Cap Thor story to tell? I came across this core of an idea that Odin had this dark secret. There's a sort of history and that we don't know about, that there's a sort of hidden thing in the Norse myth, the Norse history, and this guy was the god of fear. This was the titular serpent in the garden, the shadow that fell across all of Earth. Odin cast him out, slaughtered all of his believers, razed all of his churches and all of his temples, and has hidden his existence ever since. And then Finn, the daughter of the Red Skull, and now the new Red Skull, finds him. So,
wow.
There you go. And you've got Cap's biggest nightmare and Thor's biggest nightmare sort of hitting at the same time. And he's a god that feeds and thrives on fear itself. So the more we're afraid of him, the stronger he gets. And son of a bitch, if that ain't event-worthy. So it's a very big story. In terms of magnitude, it's, you know, for my money, it's even bigger than something like Civil War in terms of its epicness and spectacle and scale. It's very gettable. It's really simple. You don't need to have been reading 17 other books to understand where it's coming from. You don't need to read 20 books, you know, while it happens, where it goes. It's the Marvel heroes versus the God of Fear. And the more you fear him, the stronger he becomes. And ultimately, he's waging a war of terror on Earth and terrorizing and terrifying everybody. And we're all basically in that way turned into weapons. He wants Odin's throne, and only Earth stays in his way. And that's sort of, you know, that's the hook. That's it. That's all. That's it. You can come in absolutely clean. It is like Iron Man, like my Iron Man run, like my Thor run. It is designed for people who come in off the street blindly and say, "Hey, I've heard about this. What can you give me?" So it is designed to be fresh and easily gettable.
So no crossovers then with Captain?
Oh, I'm sure there will be crossovers out of it, but it's scalable in the way that you can go. You can choose to go as big or as small as you like. It's designed to arrive alongside these movies, so it's totally understandable. But if you want to branch off, you know, you can follow however everyone will have to deal with it in the Marvel Universe. You can read all the crossovers that you want, or you can just focus on the characters you want. You will not be underserved by only reading the core book. The more you read, the more you will have to enjoy, but it is a scalable as per your own desire. It's not you don't have to read 10 trillion things to figure out what's going on. And yeah, I guess that's a very short pitch. More to come.
Okay.
I don't know how much I'm saying on Tuesday yet. So
understood.
Yeah, there we go. But okay, yeah, it is huge. It is so huge. If you follow Stuart Immonen on Twitter, you've been getting a hint of the scale of how big it is. You know, kind of like everything. It makes Marvel stuff great. Very much about where we are right now. I find it very relatable to just kind of the way the world is and the shape of things are at this moment in history. And God, it's a lot of fun to write. It's the biggest thing I've ever written, and it's been coming for. I've been working on it for a long time, and you know, we decided sort of as a creative group to fall off of doing the kind of mega crossovers. For a while, partially because our own batteries need to recharge, but also we hadn't found that notion. We hadn't found that idea, and this started as a pitch for a miniseries. You know, like it would be Captain America Thor, it was called, and once the idea came out, once the idea of Odin having this kind of sinister history that really recasts who he is and how all of these characters understand where they are, I really kind of realized, oh, this, you can really... We could really run for this, and it just became bigger and bigger and bigger until we realized we were looking at our event, and son of a bitch, I was writing it. So there we go.
And I noticed in Brew's latest issue of Captain America, Sin just got released, or I should say escaped from jail by Master Man, so obviously that kind of plays into this direction.
Yeah, and you know, we're going to have Odin back on contentious terms with Thor. We've got Steve Rogers as Steve Rogers, not as Captain America. You've got something really stunning coming for Bucky Barnes that I don't know how much has been teased yet, but this could not be happening at a worse time for our guys. the heroic age feels so entirely fragile and so entirely delicate and so vaguely phony with the tone and timbre of panic in the world these days. And no one is more aware of this than Steve Rogers. So when the shit starts to come down, like this is for all the marbles. Man, I wish I could tell you. It's so big. Oh, God. it's, yeah, man, this is it. This is like, for me, like, my sweet spot of events is sort of like Secret Wars and Civil War. Like, so it's like, sure, that was always what I, those are the two things, like.
The original Secret War and Civil War?
Yeah. No disrespect to Secret Wars too. But like, just as a kid, like, that was so, like, it was just titanic. It was just boom, boom, boom. You know, it was just huge, and it was everybody you wanted to see and everybody you loved in action against everybody you hated. And it was just, you know, big. And Civil War was such like a zeitgeist book. It was so much about like 2002, you know, 2001, 2002. It so just hit where we were then. And was had all kinds of human drama amongst everything else. So I'm getting to tell these amazing character stories, these stories about these amazing characters, these big, sweeping, tragic, epic hero stories amidst a really relevant, kind of timely, like, thing. Like, in a world where houses are being foreclosed on, and you know what I mean? Like, it's just sort of the tone and timbre of the world right now is very, very high tense, very tweet. So yeah, and Marvel has always been about real people as heroes, you know, and the real world, and it's a shot through a Marvel lens. So yeah, I don't know. It is such a privilege to write, and absolutely massive, absolutely
so,
massive.
So will the Marvel 616 universe, or I should say Earth, really kind of look very much like what's going on today in the headlines? I mean, you know,
yes,
again, I
yes,
think of these teaser images that we've seen where Spider-Man seems to be more concerned about the economy,
yeah,
than ever, and you know.
Yeah. No, it is those images, those resonant images about fear. I mean, that's all of our stories are about our heroes facing their fear, mm-hmm, you know. But when you've got a villain at the heart of it all that wants you to be afraid and excels at making people afraid, and convinces you to lock your door at night and to look over your shoulder while you walk alone, and you know, it is a guy who feeds on this anxiety, and it just makes him bigger and better and stronger. It's a moment when our heroes are at their shakiest. They've got to be braver than they've ever been before, and it's tough. And some of them fail. Some of them fail profoundly. And
How long is the miniseries?
Or event? Seven issues.
Seven issues, and it starts in spring, or April, or May, or
it starts in April. Yeah, maybe
okay.
April.
Very cool.
And better. We'll run the summer. I'm sure there will be spin-offs and crossovers galore. But again, it starts with this series. This mini series is what you need. This has the whole tale. And the deeper you go is up to you. You may read what you are happy with. You may read what you wish to read, and you will get a richer, more complicated, more detailed picture. I'm really going out of my way to make this accessible to somebody who comes out of the Thor movie. What is this Marvel Universe all about? And sees, you know, hey, here's a story with Thor and Captain America, and then there we go. You know what I mean? I'm writing it to be as cleanly accessible as is possible.
Well, and not to point out the possible anxiety, but really, I mean, in this current environment of economic concern, both from a consumer standpoint and a publisher standpoint, and this, you know, $3.99, $2.99 world that we're suddenly a part of, and I'm guessing that's got to play a factor in, you know, when you are handed an event to make sure that it matters, and you know, obviously, you know, you're trying to tell the best story that you can, but, you know, do those thoughts of the marketplace kind of circle your head as you're writing?
I mean, I'm a you know, they say in certain rooms that we oftentimes find ourselves powerlessness and discover that our lives have become unmanageable and that kind of stuff. Like, I am powerless and against it, and I cannot manage it. So specifically, am I thinking about the $3.99 versus $2.99 versus where sales today debate? No. But on a macro scale, people are losing their houses. You know, people are losing their jobs, and there's not a lot of jobs left. That is much more. It's much more broad. It's much more universal. People, you know, it's a better story to tell to see somebody losing their home than somebody having to, like, not be able to read, like, The Flash this month because they can't afford it or whatever.
No, that's not what I mean. I, you know.
No, no, but yeah. I mean, is it in my head? Yes, but in a much more.
I understand. You know, broader sense, a real sense. Yeah. What matters, as opposed to exactly. I don't know.
My disposable income. Yeah, yeah.
No, and obviously, I don't mean to trivialize people's real hardships, honestly, this is, sales are down. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, really, the market isn't as strong as, say, it was when Civil War was happening.
Yep. I mean, that's no way around it. You're absolutely right. This is a book about this. This is a book about, you know, somebody who could profit from that, you know, hope it is a... as somebody who has felt awful critical of these things in the past, it's nice to have a chance to, you know, put my money where my mouth is and try to write an event that I would want to read, you know?
But also, now that's interesting, and I guess, you know, you were saying it, but to hear it directly, much like General Lucian in Brubaker's Captain America story, kind of manipulating... the real estate market and what was going on in the world and stuff. This is your opportunity to kind of really, you know, tackle real world issues and put it in a Marvel universe sense.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be careful how you contextualize it. But I mean, it is as a backdrop. It speaks really wonderfully to what the Marvel character is. You know, Spider-Man was always hustling to make ends meet. You know what I mean? It's that anxiety, financial security anxiety of surviving day to day has always been, both literally and metaphorically, surviving day to day is, you know, that is what makes these guys tick. So,
well, and being created in the atomic age and you know, fearing the national concerns of its day back in 1962 and 61 when everything started in the Marvel universe and.
Right, space race anxiety and all
exactly.
that stuff. Yeah, no, it is a chance to kind of rack focus on that on the modern equivalent of that stuff.
Very and, cool.
I couldn't be more proud and more excited and more terrified, quite honestly. But nobody wants to hear that, so it'll be awesome. It'll be amazing.
Cool, man. All right, fantastic.
Do your part to help the economy recover. Bye, too.
All right,
let me save comics. Buy two of this fucking thing.
How did your performance art thing go for? Was it Woodstock that you did during San Diego?
Yeah, for Woodstock, and then I did it like actually as my spotlight panel at San Diego. So I did it at Woodstock San Diego. I did it at Woodstock Portland first. I kind of tweaked it a little bit, and then did it twice at San Diego. I think it went okay. It was weird, you know, sort of different than a medium I'm used to working in. So it was
kind of a spoken word performance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was sort of like this is why I do comics. Kind of a history of my history of comics and and art and stuff. Yeah, I don't know. It was very. Hopefully it was entertaining.
it was on Vimeo, wasn't it? Did Kel shoot the Vimeo, or did somebody shoot the Vimeo for you guys?
No, somebody in the audience shot it at Woodstock, and then I think Comics Alliance shot it for their website.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, I don't. It wasn't like anything that was officially taped. It just sort of was taped by a few people, so. Anywho, it was
just if people have
it. It was a lot of fun to do, and very. It's good to get out of your comfort zone. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, and performing that way in front of an audience rather than a panel, a traditional panel and stuff, where you've got the comfort of you. There's somebody else on the panel, or even just that big table.
it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying.
That's cool, man. Very nice. Well, let's move on to the questions that we've got from iFanboy.com because they all came out in droves. And, all right, we'll see. Let's see how we do. We've got a ton here, but I think you're strong enough that we can clean the cake here.
Yeah, I'm feeling good. Let's do this thing.
All right. Well, we start with Jason Wood, who has a question. And now this is good because we haven't had a chance to talk about this book yet. Now that you've settled into your role as one of Marvel's main writers, it's nice to see Casanova back on the solicitations. What are your plans for Casanova in 2011 and beyond?
It's a big year for Casanova. Gula, the second volume, begins its re-release in January. It looks amazing.
Colors really make a difference, man. I got to agree.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And you should see, I'll send you some exclusive color pages that you can put up as a preview alongside this podcast.
Terrific.
Just so people believe me. It is staggering. It is breathtaking. Pre-order it today. And, that starts in January. So it'll be January, February, March, and April. And then sometime shortly thereafter, surely no later than July, the new series will begin.
Excellent. And that is that.
Script is, sent the first script over to Gabrielle a couple months ago at this point. I know he's working on it. So we are rolling.
Fantastic. And how do you see that moving forward? I mean, do you think it'll be like, because, you know, they are giving you a lot of mainstream stuff to write.
The nature of the deal we have gets them their rate. So they are no longer working for poverty, working for charity when they're no longer living in poverty, working for charity when drawing Casanova. So hopefully there will not be a break. Hopefully we will simply continue to create the book. Whether we do an arc and take a short break or do an arc and
follow up immediately the next month.
Just immediately keep rolling. We don't quite know yet, but we're going to go until we stop at this point. And if it stops again, it's because there will be no more. So we're just going to keep cranking along and tell the story at long last.
And you're bristling with ideas. I mean, you're ready to go with a whole bunch of new arcs for Casanova.
Yeah. And this first issue is like the hardest thing I've ever written. So
is it tough coming back to this?
I can't wait for it to get on the line.
Yeah, is it tough coming? I mean, this is a few years now. How many years is it between volume 2 and 3?
Yeah, a couple years. It's not just tough. It was tough for a lot of different reasons. It has to completely reinvent itself.
Sure.
Every single issue, every single arc has to be a completely unique. So it had to be kind of reinvented. And I felt like I kept getting the more of these, you know, the more pages I write a day, every day, consecutively, like the more ideas I had, the more experience I got, I felt like I was becoming a better, you know, person who does what I do. So there were a few false starts where I felt like I can write this better now. And I think I started it 6 or 7 times and got into it, like a chunk of pages, and then I had to stop and restart and stop and restart and stop and restart. Or I would read something that I felt challenged me and that was exciting in like a provocative kind of way. And then suddenly it wasn't good enough. It was a beast.
Okay. Is there room in your schedule for additional creator-owned ideas to come out, or are you at your maximum with this load?
Fear itself has been so huge in my landscape since July, basically, that I don't know the answer to that question right now.
Okay.
I went long periods over the summer where all I was doing was outlining Fear itself and not invoicing. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. It was spooky, and it has, as such, it has this inordinately large place in my head right now. But as more of the issues get written, I'll get a feeling for, you know, how much work it's going to be. Hopefully, we've basically just reshifted all the work, so all the heavy lifting has already been done, and now it's just a matter of kind of executing. The first script was one of the most heavily read things I've ever done internally at Marvel. A lot of eyes were on it, and a lot of drafts were done to get it where I wanted it. And editorially, you know, to kind of incorporate in an editorial and all that stuff. And to get it to a place where everybody was like, yeah, this is it. It kind of took forever, but now we're there. It's like, all right, let's, hopefully we've now gotten through all the growing pains, and it'll just be like writing any other series at this point. Otherwise, I'm just going to kill myself. So we'll see where we're at.
And I should ask, who is editing Fear Itself? Who's the big editor in charge? Is it Tom?
I suspect it will be Tom Brevoort's name at the end of the day. This first issue has many cooks in its kitchen. But it wasn't frustrating. You know what I mean? It was a lot of work, but I didn't ever feel like I was getting stupid notes. I mean, it didn't feel like I was working in advertising. You know what I mean? It just felt like this is really important. We gotta hit this and have these people giving you their opinion of what you're writing. Like, oh, right. I get it. So hopefully the hard work pays off.
How much breaks during, and forgive me for staying after itself, but now this is inspiring new questions. How much of it breaks during, say, the summit when you guys are kind of hammering this thing up versus, okay.
It started in the summit. I mean, it was one of the things we came, at the summit was let's talk about this Cap 4 mini. And it was sort of in the telling of that that it became what it became.
Okay.
It was very, very live in the room. It was very much sort of, it was a miniseries. Like I said, it was the Cap 4 miniseries. And it was in working that through that it kind of, as it was being pitched, it became the behemoth.
Okay. And obviously, as you say, this started as a Cap 4 miniseries. So they're already presented to, say, Tom or an editor before a summit? I just wonder in terms of ideas in general.
Yeah, Tom. I mean, it started with Tom calling and saying, this was, oh, shit. God, like a year ago? Can that be right? No, it must have been, like, early spring.
Okay.
Like January, February. And as they were putting that, putting the schedule together for the year, they're like, okay, movie time, what are we doing for the, what are we doing for the summer?
Right.
You know what I mean? So it was just that kind of editorial, hey, maybe look around, see, see if there's a Cap Thor idea that makes sense to capitalize on the movies coming out, it's sort of very innocently, just sort of, hey, this is probably a thing we should have out when the movie comes out.
Well, you've been going to a lot of these, big summit writing meetings and everything. When you go to them, is it always with an idea that's already been passed around the table once, or how many of your ideas do you first introduce at, say, a summit like that?
It's I don't want to say like 50-50, but there's a mix for
sure. It's organic, depending on the time.
Like I pitched on Iron Man live in the room with no foreknowledge that it was, I had a night to think about it, basically, and walked in and just kind of kept listening to what everybody was saying and thinking, like, I want to pitch on an Iron Man book. I want to pitch on this Iron Man book that's coming. Whereas something like this, it worked through with Tom and stuff like that. So it depends. Usually the editor of your book knows what you're going to talk about.
Gotcha.
But then there's always the unpredictable.
Sure. Okay. Well, and this kind of dovetails into the next question. David Tobin 100 asks, what are your thoughts about the Marvel Architects Initiative?
Thank you for your question, David. It's flattering. And I understand, I think, what they're trying to say and what they're going for. I feel that if any of the other, 92 guys who are busting their ass running the best that they can for Marvel feel slighted and devalued, I can understand, how that could, cause hurt feelings. But I also think it's a piece of PR and a marketing initiative,
Yes.
Nobody complained that Ariel Olivetti wasn't actually young when he was named a young gun. you know what I mean? So it's flattering and it's great. I understand why and where it's coming from, especially knowing what I know about Fear Itself and knowing what's coming beyond Fear Itself. So yeah, I mean it's like everything else that comes out with Marvel's name on it and my name on it. I don't kind of can't believe it on some level. It's very magical.
Chop360, if you can write a mini
that is not his Christian name.
I'm guessing no. If you could write
or her,
it could be a her. If you could write a miniseries based on Thor and any X-Men characters, which X-Men would it be, and what type of story would you tell? Thor and the X-Men.
Thor, Wolverine, and they would just kill the shit out of a lot of stuff.
That makes sense. All right.
I don't know. I just that seems like let's give Thor and Wolverine a heavy metal record to fight the way out.
Roy Vampire. That sounds like a Christian name.
Totally fake.
This might be too specific, but it's been intriguing me ever since it happened. When Doctor Strange was in Tony's mind before Siege, he made a comment about how no one in the Marvel Universe refers to the armor as the Iron Man except for Tony. I don't know why this line is stuck in my head. Are there plans to explore this any further, or is that just an observation by Doctor Strange?
Yeah, no, I think it's just what I think Tony thinks about it, you know, like it's a car or the car, you know. I think it's the Iron Man. It's a project. It was a thing that I first, I think Warren Ellis did it first, and Extremis. It was just, there's something very perfectly analytical about it. I think speaks volumes to, well, I mean, volumes, but it's just, it was a nice character note.
Sure. Kelvin.
So at the moment, I have nothing outlined to plan on analyzing or looking into Tony's linguistic decisions, but it sounds right.
I hope you get a chance to write more Doctor Strange, because that was one.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah, the Ditko Kung Fu Fingers got me all kinds of Twitter hated.
It's true. How long are you planning on staying on? This is Kelboy asking this question. Oh, yeah, I think we did cover this. Excuse me. How long you plan on staying on Uncanny X-Men? Please say for a very long time.
I hope, yeah. It's, it's not for me to say.
Fair enough. All right. Any plans for other X titles or crossovers?
Oh, always. It's the X-Men universe.
Okay, and Kelboy cannot wait for Volume 3 of Casanova.
Thank you, sir. Neither, or Madam. Neither can I.
Batman.
Seriously,
2.
It's the most complicated. Oh, my God. It is. Ugh, man. I don't know. Sometimes you just got to go for it, you know?
Understood.
Maybe it's all. And I'm half. I don't know. Maybe it's gibberish. I don't know. But it's. Well, it's good to work in a way that feels this wildly uncomfortable. The other thing, too, is I went back when it was time to write it, and I reread all of Cass, and I never reread my work. Beyond like, oh, wait, what was that guy's name? You know what I mean? Like, very superficial kind of stuff. Like, I sat down and read it all cover to cover and was struck with this feeling that it's not as good as I thought it was. So, like, it was, there's a lot of uncertainty and self-doubt, you know, going into it. So, I just keep making it sound better and better.
Yeah, well, no, but
anyway, it is a journey. And I think Gabriel hates me.
Well, it does have its own language, and I can appreciate coming back to it and yeah, wondering, you know, what more you have to say in that world.
Yeah, it everything, you know, it continues on and complexifies and it picks up exactly where we left off. It is the opposite of Volume 1. Casanova 3 starts off with Casanova hating his job and hating his life and being trapped under the... under his father's paw and struggling desperately to get out of it, trying to find a way to get out of it if it's at all possible. So we've gone from the very high in love with life and everything about it, Casanova of Volume 1, to a beat-down working man, Casanova, desperate for a way out.
Batman 2. If you ever went,
it had to have been a bummer that there was already that name was already taken. There's already a one out there. It sucks so much.
Fuck. If you ever went over to DC, which character would you rather write? And he has three specific ideas: the Challengers of the Unknown, Dead Man, or the Question.
I probably Challengers of the Unknown.
Cool. Love the Challengers.
Yeah.
Bought The Essential or The Showcase just recently.
Yeah. And kind of, you know, traipse about in that some of that kind of Kirby space. And, Dead Man just seems so, I don't know, maybe Dead Man.
That's a hell of a challenge. And, I mean, I like what Johns is doing right now and Tomasi in Brightest Day. But I always think Dead Man is, you know, whenever, like, a new Dead Man ongoing happened, I'm like, this isn't going to last, because how the hell do you keep doing this? You know, there's a very rigid path. That's why Brightest Day is so interesting, that, well, wait a minute, Dead Man's alive now. So now what do you do?
Right. Right now he's a live man.
Man.
I mean, it would be one of those, it would have to kind of be like I think the interesting thing about Dead Man to me would require a sort of like a vertigo-y Animal Man kind of reboot of the character and who he is. It's a little counter to what he's been doing in Brightest Day. So we'll say the Challengers. Well, that's a clean and untouched.
Fair enough.
Challengers.
Were you, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this, were you a fan of, and I know you just talked to Denny O'Neil last year for Comics Journal. That was an awesome article. Fantastic interview. Oh, you guys really covered some interesting stuff, but I can imagine that his question run.
There's all kinds of shit that didn't actually run. That was the crazy part. I was really interviewing him about his entire life. It was pretty great.
Hey, man, if you got the tapes, Word Balloon is always here. So
I do not, alas, but it was a real honor and privilege to talk to him. Iron Man 500.1 is dedicated to Denny.
Oh, very cool.
Did a lot of great work for Iron Man, and did a lot of influential work on me, and it seemed the least I could do to write a book to thank him. So when you read the .1 issue of Iron Man, it is for Denny.
Very cool. Yeah, what else can you tell us about the .1 issue? I should have asked you about that.
It is designed to be accessible to people who haven't read the book or want to check it out. I mean, it's sort of, I was really obsessed with the idea of taking advantage of the marketing opportunity that this kind of initiative is presenting and try and get new readers. So it is, Tony, telling his life story. From his youth, we get to see a lot of Tony as a kid that we've never seen before. So Tony is a teenager up to the present day. It is a crash course through not only the history of what I've been writing, but of all of Iron Man history, done in a whirlwind blast of pages. I'm really happy with it. It was one of the very, very difficult thing to write, but the short version is it's Tony doing his drunk log at an AA meeting. So it's Tony telling his own story. But with lots of cutaways, and we get to see, there's a lot of as much showing as there is telling, but the context for the opportunity for Tony to take a second and kind of examine his life he's picking up a chip at AA. So it's a little heavy.
Cool. Jetstorm, how did it go with your Iron Fist pitch? Are we going to see it anytime soon, or does the new Power Man and Iron Fist story conflict with it?
It conflicts with it a little bit, only that I suspect if something happens with it, it will happen as a part of Fear itself. It's interesting being a part of this. I can kind of sketch out like ideas for, here's where a so-and-so miniseries could work. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And this is one of those things where there's not room for it in the main story, but I'll put it down on a piece of paper and maybe it can be pitched to somebody else. Maybe nothing will happen with it. I don't know. I thought I was done with them. And then as I was working on Fear itself, I found a Danny story, that excited me. So, I don't know. Stay tuned. It wasn't really, it was never really pitched per se. I just sort of knew as the more and more I wrote Fear itself, the more and more it didn't fit. I was trying to shoehorn in a character that I loved that didn't necessarily, that ultimately distracted from what the main event was. So maybe there will be an Iron Fist spinoff that I'll be involved with in some way as part of, Fear itself, and maybe not. We'll see.
RPG. I'd like to think that an author can better write an established character if they find a bit of themselves in that character. What is it about Tony and Iron Man's character that you identify with? And did you feel that emphasizing that trait was important during your run?
Tony is an alcoholic in recovery, and I am an alcoholic in recovery. It's a little ugly. It's a little,
Is that true?
Yeah, it sounds kind of dramatic, but yeah.
Okay.
And that at its roots, and I know what it's like to be an alcoholic in recovery that doesn't go to meetings. And doesn't necessarily drink, but doesn't necessarily behave like a sober person either. And sobriety is a bit more than not drinking. On some core level, there was that. And when I looked at where Tony was post-Civil War, running SHIELD and everything, I thought that he looked to me like a, like a drunk that wasn't going to meetings. So that was kind of the root of it. And you know, spinning out of there, I oftentimes would like to believe that I am the smartest guy in a room and hate finding out that that is not the case. I can be arrogant and sarcastic and everything else. You know, he's so incredibly flawed, and I am as well. So it was not hard to map my flaws to his in a way that I could connect with. But at the root, you know, my Tony is very much a guy with a drinking problem that doesn't drink anymore. So
that's all interesting. Born of that. What and again, it was the five. Was it the five fears of Tony? Was that your first?
No, five nightmares.
Five nightmares. Okay. So yeah, it does.
And the first of which was that he was going to start drinking again.
There you go. Interesting.
So, yeah, I am subtle like a car crash.
Well, you know, I'm the comic book Oprah. Feel free. It's quite all right.
When is your favorite things show happening? That's what I want to hear.
Everyone reach under their seat. You're getting a point one issue. Harpo the Dope, ladies and gentlemen. To another DC question.
Harpo, thank you, sir. All right.
If you worked for DC, which books would you want to work on in the current DCU or just in general? I'd love to see you and the twins take on classic Plastic Man.
It seems like there is a low-hanging fruit on the Plastic Man tree. I don't understand why no one's grabbed it, but I don't know. You know, I'm never fond of answering these questions specifically because I feel like it suggests that I feel that regardless of who's doing the book now, I could do it better.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there's a lot of great characters over there. There's a lot of fun stuff. There's a lot of fun that could and that could be had and that should be had over there. So yeah.
All right. Rob Abston. Now that Tesla...
That actually sounds like a real name.
Now that Tesla and Twain are back on top of our national pop culture consciousness, who do you believe will be the next Edwardian-era man or woman of action to make their triumphant return to prominence? That's a good kind of history trivia question.
Yeah, shit. Oh, Lincoln. It's going to be Lincoln.
Is that Edwardian? Is that late enough?
Does that count? Well, I mean, yeah, he was, what, 1864?
Is that I don't know, man.
Twain and Tesla were 1899. So
yeah, that's what I said. It's like a 25-year swing there, Chief. I don't know.
He predates him a little bit, but get ready for Lincoln, man. Lincoln's coming.
Big. It's coming and
I'm surprised
coming
it didn't happen already because of the bicentennial, but Lincoln. There's gold on the Lincoln Hills.
There you go. Did you see, by the way, it occurs to me, another anniversary of sorts, Lennon's death. Did you see the American Masters thing about Lennon in New York, John Lennon?
I saw Kel watched it. I caught chunks of it.
Man, was it good.
Yeah. I remember that. Just turned five.
Wow.
I turned five. My birthday is December 1st.
Yes, I know.
And that was the 7th. So, like, I had just turned five. And, I remember it clear as a bell. That whole week I remember. And eventually my dad, who – it was my first experience seeing adults sad.
Sure.
Yeah. And I couldn't understand, and my dad didn't try to explain to me who John Lennon was in a while. These people were so upset, just sat me down in front of the stereo with, Beatles records. It was the beginning of my life as a Beatles fan, and it has been a lifelong fandom ever since, you know. It's very hard for me to watch. Like, Sean Lennon and I are right around the same age. He was born in October and I was born in December, so it was like a, it was hard for me to watch for any number of reasons, and I kind of avoided it from like sitting down and watching it, just because it's just it bums me out for a lot of different reasons. I remember Larry Lujack, man, Larry Lujack and WLS.
Yeah, absolutely. Chicago's very
like the Walter Cronkite of Chicago radio, like
from a rock standpoint, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so it was, here is a funny story about John Lennon's death. I dated a girl once whose dad was quite possibly the biggest Beatlemaniac I've ever met. I take it back. Joe Quesada is the biggest Beatlemaniac I've ever met. This girl's dad was a close second. Oh, Joe, oh my God, man, get Joe going about the Beatles. It's terrific. So I date this girl, and she was born on December 7th. Or the 8th, I'm sorry. She was born
December 8th. 8th. Okay, yeah, the death day.
So she is born the day that John Lennon is murdered.
Oh.
And we're dating. It's her birthday. Her family's taking her out to dinner. Her dad makes a toast. You know, I just want to thank everybody for coming out tonight, you know.
No.
And I would like to just raise a glass to this we will always remember this day in our hearts and our lives. The day that the greatest musician of all time was shot dead in New York City. John Lennon, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, and happy birthday, honey. Swear to God, John. Swear to God.
Daddy issues abound. That's fantastic. Oh, my God. There's a Sally Jesse Raphael right there.
Oh, it's crazy, right? Oh, man. It was so great.
Boy, my dad still haunts me with that crap. I hate him.
Yeah, seriously. This girl was just like, listen, my dad is like a Beatles freak. And there's John Lennon died. He ruins my birthday every year with some fucking bullshit. Some other bullshit. And sure enough, he did.
Oh.
The fire's going good now. There we go.
Jeez.
It's cracking.
Oh, there you go. Very nice. Stoke it, buddy. Yeah. There you go. If you'll pardon the expression. There you go. You see, and of course, you were 5 years old. I was a sophomore in high school. And And remember hearing the news from Howard Cosell during Monday Night Football. So.
Right. That's right. I've seen that clip. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeesh. So, all right. On to happier things. But again, I would say to those not traumatized by Lennon's death, please watch the American Masters.
The stuff
it's
I saw was terrific. I really love that we, as a culture, are growing up enough to accept the possibility that maybe Yoko Ono didn't break up the Beatles.
Yeah, no shit. I know it's taken us 30 years, but yeah.
Yeah. Maybe she's not this
40 years,
castrating yellow peril harpy that she's so easily been stereotyped as every fucking day of her life since the White Album came out. What a magnificent woman! What a remarkable woman!
No, you're right about that, and she does get cooler every year. That. She comes back and reminds us that, yeah, it's okay.
Well, there's that terrific, last year with the remasters, there's that amazing, I want to say it was Michael Gilmore, but suddenly I'm not sure, a piece in Rolling Stone called The End of the Beatles. It was just such a breathtaking reconsideration and reexamination of what actually happened and where the fault laid. And it laid at the feet of John Lennon. It was about money and Lennon, and the most remarkable thing was when Paul left the meeting where they broke up and was sitting in a limousine being driven away, his thought wasn't, oh my God, I left the Beatles. It was, oh my God, now Yoko is alone to deal with him.
Interesting.
And this just sort of, as I've gotten older and learned a few things, just the complex emotional and creative dynamic that is created by the group dynamic of those four men are fascinating. I recommend seeking out the issue. It's a terrific piece. It's a terrific piece of writing. It's a great it's not even reconsideration. It's just a great representation of history. I hope Yoko Ono, is thought of as, the hero she is, the artist she is, woman that took away what would have inevitably been shitty Beatles records from you.
And that's what came out, too, in this American Masters piece, because it really is about that last decade of his life. And you do see how all of his friends...
The long weekend thing. That was what... when there's this whole thing after the fight at the Troubadour his buddies called her, and she said, no, you fucking deal with him.
Right,
and they do...
That's where he was at the Harry Nilsson. He and Harry Nilsson were at the Smothers Brothers performance, and right, making right. asses
out of themselves. Is this a place to fucking throw down with some bitches? If there's a place where you are going to just start some shit with some punk-ass bitches, it is at a Smothers Brothers show. Am I right?
Now they were rebel rousers. Don't get now, you know. But still,
yeah,
I understand.
Man, what a fiery color of ascot he's wearing tonight.
Oh, stop!
Yeah, exactly. Was that the Troubadour? No, that's unfair. Talk about unfair.
That's all right. No,
Big Smothers.
They were tough. No, hey man, Tommy Smothers. You got to do some reading, Maddie. That's all right. That's
I know they got kicked off. I know.
Oh no, yeah, they were. They're cooler than you think. Granted, it was crappy folk music, but there was a message under that crappy folk music.
I know. I just think they're funny.
Mom always liked you best. All right.
I did the yo-yo thing. I learned how to yo-yo because I thought that Tommy Smothers was all like the yo-yo man shit was so cool. I was like, oh my god, I want to learn how to yo-yo. What the hell does that say about me? Jesus Christ.
There you go. Part one of my conversation with Matt Fraction. Part two coming up on Tuesday. Again, apologies if you're finally receiving this version of the episode. Not sure what happened, but hopefully these changes will rectify things. And the people who have the old Word Balloon feed will have received this episode. And everything should be right as rain moving forward. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress saying, don't forget to find Word Balloon all over the internet. We're at wordballoon.com, at iFanboy every Tuesday. You can follow us on Twitter under my name, John Word Balloon, or at Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Questions or comments about the show, email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks again for listening. The band will be back, I promise. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010. Merry Christmas.